is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard! My guest today is Hugo-nominated author Marie Vibert, whose recent novels include The Gods Awoke and Galactic Hellcats. Hi, Marie. Welcome to Retro Rockets. Can you introduce yourself to our listeners and let us know where we can find you online?
Sure. So I'm Marie Vibert, and I've written a lot of short stories, something like 90 short stories. I have a website. It's marievibert.com. I have 3 novels also, and I was a Hugo and Nebula finalist this year, or last year now.
Congratulations on the nominations. And you and I actually got to talk a little bit about this. At the moment, this conversation occurred about a month ago. We met up at Confusion, a science fiction convention outside Detroit. We were talking in January, and we had this wonderful conversation about Chengdu Worldcon. And, you know, your face just absolutely lit up of just all the neat things there. So I'm kind of going to ask you to just repeat some of that. What was it like to go? And I remember you saying it had kind of a tech trade show vibe and just really, really neat to be there.
It was very different. This would have been like my third Worldcon that I'd been to, but it was very different from the other two. And it was, I was not going to go. I actually didn't vote for China for the bid purely out of self-interest, because like there's no way I could afford to go to China. But then I got nominated and I got a free trip. They paid for my trip. So it was a once in a lifetime experience to be able to go to China, to be able to experience this. And the convention itself was, yes, it was very much more like what you might see at a trade show, more like what you might see at a GDC or a Comic Con. It had this very commercial vibe to it. They built a building for this.
Wasn't it like just a big convention hotel or something? It had its own,
they built a building. It was the Chengdu Science Fiction Museum, which maybe it'll continue to be like a children's museum or something. I'm not sure. But yes, the building was built for the convention. This was its opening. And it was this brand new, very sleek silver spaceship of a building on one end of a beautiful park, like a mile wide park with a man-made lake, a little mini man-made beach, walking paths, topiaries, statues, gardens, the works. And the building next to the hotel was brand new too.
That's incredible. Just things just like sprouting up out of the ground for this event.
I'm told that's one of the things that China's really good at, is just building crap really fast. And they the area was new and on the outskirts of the city. The hotel was brand new. The building next door included a real estate office, which had a panoramic diorama of the area without the science museum in it. So clearly,
Clearly, the museum was brand new.
brand spanking new. They said that, I mean, the convention ended up being delayed because they had to finish it. And they had giant statues, like they had the giant like robot from Wandering Earth in the lobby. They had a giant mural of the Hugo Award on the wall outside of Hugo Hall, which was where the awards were. We had our own like auditorium. The special effects were amazing. The show was gala. And it attracted a lot of people from around the world, which was really cool. It was people for whom, coming to China was not too far away and too expensive. We saw a lot of people from Serbia. I guess Serbia, you don't need a visa from Serbia to China. I learned this. And there were people from Japan and Singapore and all over that Asia area and but also people from South America. Of course, a lot of people from Scotland because of the Glasgow Worldcon Committee. I just really enjoyed how international it was and getting to meet and talk to my fellow writers from around the world. I got to talk with people from South America and Europe about science fiction. I got to talk to lots of the locals, the Chinese fans about science fiction, and
Oh, that's
it
so
was a lot of
fun.
fun. I didn't speak a well, like I could say hello and thank you in Chinese, but I could talk end up talking with them about Farscape or it was what was the one that I was surprised was pretty big there. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Lots of people had seen Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. there,
Oh,
which I enjoyed.
okay then. I love hearing about just the huge international crowd. Yes, going to China is a very, very long plane trip for Americans, but if you live in Asia, it's not that long of a flight. It's not that, you may have already been there before, so it's more convenient for just a different crowd than you might get at a Worldcon that's in Chicago or in Los Angeles. Just a
Yeah.
different crowd.
I think it's good that the Worldcon moves around then,
Yeah.
It's not always going to be convenient to me, but it'll be convenient to somebody else. Despite all of the
Despite,
problems, yeah.
yeah.
And it's a shame that the problems are a shame. Part of me was like, oh, I'm so glad that my category didn't have anybody weirdly disqualified. And I didn't win, so it's okay. I don't have to feel guilty. But that sounded flippant.
I don't think it
Obviously,
did. Yeah.
my personal, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that I'm glad that we tried it, and I wish that the committee had been a little more brave and a little bit more intellectually honest. One of the things I love about the Hugos is the fact that the voting and nomination statistics are made public. I love that transparency. And I think the Hugos can shake this off and continue forward in the future. And if they find themselves in a situation of being in a place that is known for its censorship, they can ask ahead of time. It's like, hey, we're not going to censor our stuff. Is that okay? And if you say it's not, we're not going to have our convention there. Instead, it was all, it seems to me at least, that it was all the Western organizers going, we're just going to assume that we have to censor.
And they may not have needed to censor anything. They made this gigantic assumption. But yeah, it's I agree with you. I think it can be recovered from, and I even with all of what happened, I'm still really pleased that there was such that there was a Worldcon that felt like the world
I
instead of
agree. And
just the West.
yes. And I am excited that several of the people that I met there are planning to go to Glasgow too. And it would be great to see them again. And who knows where we'll be after this? I think it would be great. There was a bid for Uganda. And let's spread the word. Let's get Worldcon off. Truly to be a worldwide phenomenon.
I like that goal. I can stand behind that goal of make it a worldwide event, make it a worldwide phenomenon, and
Especially now, the barrier for translation just keeps getting lower. The technology available for translation is getting better so that it's less labor intensive to translate. And we have so much more access to other countries' writings today than we did ever in the past.
I love getting getting the anthologies that are from other countries or other regions. It's, don't get me wrong, I love reading stuff that, takes place in a city or a country that I've been to, but I'm also really, really interested in what are other people writing? What's something I've never seen before? And
Right.
that's
Yeah.
how I get that stuff, is I read translated works from other countries.
Right. Yeah. And I'm very excited that I've reached the point in my career where my stuff is starting to be translated. And knowing that, people that I would never be able to afford to travel to visit can still read my words. That's
That's
so cool.
exciting. What do you know, like what languages has your work been translated into?
My work has been translated into Chinese, Vietnamese, Czech, and I think French
That is fantastic. I
so
love
far.
that.
And so if you're listening and you would like to translate my works into another language, please let me know. I've also done an essay that was translated into Portuguese.
Fantastic. So I know we could talk about Hugo stuff forever, but I want to talk about your books 'cause they're awesome.
Yay.
We were actually talking for a couple of minutes before we started the interview. I recently finished your novel Galactic Hellcats, and it is so such a fun book. Just really fun. Something I really loved about it is the characters, the women who make up the gang are just so drastically different. Their personalities are drastically different. Like in my mind, I was thinking to myself, what if these folks have been friends in high school? Or what if they've been like, no, you're too weird for me?
No, I don't think that they would have.
No.
Yeah. That's what I wanted. I wanted this sense of three very, or four, if we count Thane, four people from vastly different backgrounds, each from a different socioeconomic class, even, who are thrown together by events. And it was kind of a labor of love, this particular book. I had been trying to sell a novel for a long time, failing miserably. I still don't have an agent. If you're an agent and you're listening, please represent me. I write a lot, but I'm not good at selling myself. And that's why nobody's going to ever represent me. Okay. See right
Be
there? I
nicer
just
to
admitted to
yourself.
being bad at it. And yeah, nobody wants a good writer. They want somebody who has a good platform. Anyway,
I
I
want a good
digress.
writer.
Thank you. So I got frustrated, and I was trying to hone my craft and write this perfect novel, and nothing was working. And finally, I said, you know what? I just want to write something fun, like when I really enjoyed writing when I was in junior high. And when I was in junior high, I actually was this would have been 1998. When I was in eighth grade, my sister Gracie drew a sketch on one of our school notebooks of three kind of punk-looking chicks. And I decided to write a story about them. And that was the origin of the Galactic Hellcats. And I had written this very bad, very juvenile novel at 13.
Well, we're kids. Of course it's going to be juvenile. We're preteens.
Which I still have. I found it recently in my old papers, written in purple pen. And Grace was like, "Yeah, it was my purple pen, girl. I used up my sister's purple pen."
We won't we're gonna like your sister and my sister can't listen to this episode because I'll confess to all the things that I took from my sister.
And anyway, so yeah, there I was, and I was like, I want to recapture that glory. So I decided to write it again, the story of the Galactic Hellcats, who were originally called the Stardust Gang, which is terrible. It was one of my first readers in my writing workshop who suggested the title Galactic Hellcats instead. That is much better than Stardust Gang. Thank you, Mike. But it just kind of flowed. It was so easy to write because I kind of knew the story already and how they get together. And I wanted them to rescue a prince. And then, it became a little bit more involved. And when I was 13, I was like, you know what? The prince should join the gang. And I made the prince gay because I didn't want it to be romantic. I didn't want to have that awkward thing where somebody rescues somebody and then they end up dating, which always struck me as kind of,
It's kind of can get a little Stockholm syndromey sometimes, and because the prince is gay, it also gives this really interesting side story of, his family wants to marry him off, and his mother, it's very important to his mother to make a good match, and everyone in his family is assuming, well, you're going to marry a princess, and you and the princess are going to pop out a bunch of babies. And it's like, well, no, that's not what he wants with his life. And I really appreciated that he's like, no, I'm not doing that.
And it gave me, a reason for him to need to get away from his family other than his mom being mean, but his mom is mean.
She is mean.
She is super mean. It's one of those unabashed,
Just
unapologetic.
awful people.
There is no hero in her own story thing happening here. She's the villain.
Yeah,
And
she's
so
terrible. And I liked Margot a lot. I felt like I really related to her of, she's kind of feeling adrift and her family just assumes, oh, you're going to get a great job and everything's going to be wonderful. And it's so easy to get a job that pays a lot of money. And her experience of, yeah, that's not how this works. I really related to that. Like every time I've been in the job market, and it's terrifying. And
It is.
it was nice to get to hang out with a character who was experiencing something that I had experienced. So thank you for putting her in there and kind of speaking to what she was going through.
Yeah, Margot is my middle class character, and like I said, I had this whole idea where like they are each from a different social economic class. They each have something they need and something they want. And that was my notes when I was writing. It's like, okay, they each have to have something they need and something they want, and they each have to find out that they each have to choose what they need over what they want. And what Margot really needed wasn't a job, it was sense of belonging. And but yeah, no, my parents were, well, I was raised by a single father, and he was like, go to college, get into college, go to college, and you'll be set for life. And, you know, he didn't go to college. He didn't know. And I went to college and I got a bachelor's degree. And then I was like, okay, where's my set for life cue? Where do I sign up? Not so much, right?
That was my experience. It was go to college and get a degree, and then just somehow magically a career will pop out of nowhere and you will magically make a lot of money, and none of those things happened. So
it was easy. It was easier for the boomers. They had the post-war boom and stuff, but not us.
Yeah. So do we get to see more of the Galactic Hellcats? I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's something you're allowed to talk about.
I've written a sequel. It's not sold to anybody yet. Unfortunately, the publisher of Galactic Hellcats Vernacular Books has folded. You can still get Galactic Hellcats because they reverted the rights to me, and I just put it up on Ingram Spark as a, print on demand. So you can still get Galactic Hellcats. It's technically self-published right now, even though I suck at that. But I have to find somebody to publish a sequel. I don't feel comfortable as a self-publisher because I don't have the hustle that I see in the self-publishing world. I really, really want a publisher. So I'm working on that, on finding a publisher for the sequel, Galactic Hellcats 2, or Hellcats and an Andre. I also need a title. I decided to write it from the point of view of Andre the sex bot, who shows up, I think, in chapter 14.
Yeah, he shows up near the end. And yeah. He's great. So everybody listening to this episode, is it Ingram Spark?
Yes.
Go to Ingram Spark, buy a copy of Galactic Hellcats, because I need this book to blow up so I can get the sequel.
Yes. The more copies I sell, the more attractive it'll look to a publisher to pick up the series. You can in fact buy it anywhere books are sold. They will order from Ingram. So I recommend your local independent bookstore. I like to go to Max Bax in Cleveland, Ohio. That's my personal favorite bookstore.
Excellent. Let's see, the bookstore closest to me is Lowry's. And they have new books, but they're more of a famous used bookstore.
Yeah,
and cool. It's one of these like old buildings that just kind of winds and you get lost. And it's like, oh no, I've reached a dead end. How do I get out of this bookstore? Oh no, I'm trapped in the bookstore. This is terrible.
It sounds absolutely, absolutely terrible.
It is fantastic.
Yeah. The thing I like about Max Bax is it's also a used bookstore, and they have this balcony, which is the science fiction balcony, and it kind of feels like being in somebody's attic.
That's fun.
It smells like paperbacks up there. Yeah, I just kind of want to live up there.
That's fantastic. Thanks for listening to Retro Rockets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson, and our guest today is Marie Vibbert. Join us on Blue Sky at retrorockets.bsky.social. So I know, like, I am super, like, over the moon for Galactic Hellcats, but you have another book out recently as well called The Gods Awoke. Yes. I haven't had a chance to read this one yet, but it's on my stack of books. And so I was looking at some reviews online of The Gods Awoke, and some folks were mentioning, like, young gods trying to figure out their place in the world, people trying to figure out, like, what do I think, what do I believe, what's important to me, and something that really jumped out at me, and which is a storytelling framing that I love, is how does what we believe shape our world?
Yeah. So this was, I wrote this before I wrote Galactic Hellcats. This was back when I was trying to write the perfect novel, believing that that would get me published. So this was my attempt to be very literary. And I decided to write it from first person omniscient point of view. So in every scene, you get this omniscient point of view where the omniscient character, Sene, the trickster goddess, can see all of the thoughts and feelings and emotions of all the people around her simultaneously. So it feels almost like a balanced third person, which we don't get as much as we used to in the fiction world, where we don't have a single point of view, except we do. See why I can't sell any novels, but I did sell this one. And that was because Journey Press was like, "Hey, we like your writing, your short stories. Do you have any novels?" And I was like, "Here, take this one." And they were like, "Oh, that's cool." But yeah, so it's a secondary world where, much to the surprise of the people living in this world, which has sort of a like pre-modern technology level. I didn't want it to be a direct corollary to any particular time period on Earth either. So like I did a lot of angsty research on what do you have to invent before you can invent, before you can invent, and it's not going to go the same as in our world.
Oh, interesting. I'm going to have to ask you more questions about that.
But then one day suddenly miracles start happening, and it seems like the gods that they worship exist after all, and they're not prepared for that, and neither, ironically, are the gods. They're like, "Wait, what? How long have I existed? I'm not sure. Why can't I remember past last Thursday?" And so the main story problem is from the point of view of this goddess, Sene, who's trying to figure out, well, why can't I remember back past a certain time? Why are things not quite the way I expect them to be? Why weren't we here earlier? Etc. And she does find an answer.
I just absolutely got chills about the idea of, whenever I read like mythology stories or, fantasy mythology, it's, well, of course, the gods have been here forever. Everybody knows that. And, Athena has been around forever. Everybody knows that. So a story where there are deities who do what deities do, and they haven't been around forever, or have they? Like, that just absolutely fascinates me. And I'm also very, very fascinated about some of the research that you did of, can you have a world where this exists, but maybe this other thing doesn't exist?
Right, so they have glass. A lot of their technology is based on glass. They have the ability to create to use basic natural gas and oil burners with glass, but they don't have internal combustion engines yet. But they do have water wheels, and they have a trolley system that runs off of water wheels. So like that, it's a little steampunky.
That's very
Maybe
cool, very cool. And
we'll call it like ceramic punk. I don't know.
oh, I dig that ceramic punk.
Yeah, I like I said, I did more world building here than I normally had done in the past, where I really asked a lot of deep questions. It doesn't all make it into the book, obviously, but that was part of where I was as a writer at the time, struggling to just, I don't know, I wanted everybody to think I was smart. But the tagline that the publisher chose is like, "If the gods were real, would you believe?" And that is kind of the central question that some of the characters have to deal with, especially Hitra, who is a priestess, is one of the main characters. And really, the main characters are Hitra, her live-in servant Eloi, and this goddess. And Eloi is an atheist, and Hitra is a priestess. And the goddess obviously is a goddess. And
But like
they all have.
yeah, like Hitra's probably been doing all of these rituals just like, well, this is what I do, and
Right.
you know, these are the steps, and I just kind of do this thing because it's my job. Without, you know, you know, maybe she's never gotten any proof of God's
Right, she's never gotten
existing.
any proof.
Yeah.
And that was expected that you wouldn't have any proof, and that part of having faith was accepting the tenets of the religion without proof. So, in a way, her faith is shaken by this. And there's a really cool, like, she has a really cool scene near the middle where she's talking with this leader of a splinter sect whose faith was also shaken, but in a different way. And like, it's kind of about how people need different things from religion. And it's not necessarily what we talk about when we talk about religion.
It feels a little bit like what you said earlier, even with like a completely different novel of there's what you want and there's what you need, and which one are you going to chase after? And chances are what you need, you weren't even thinking about before. So this book just leapt to the top of my TBR, so thank you.
I'm a big believer in the Gospel of Saint Mick. You can't always get what you want, but
Yes.
if you try sometimes, you'll get what you need.
Best earworm ever. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit. And, you know, I follow you on social media and I'm chronically online, but still somehow it's like
Same.
hard to find fun stuff. But I happened to be online and you were online and you posted a link to your website and you had this blog post that just like grabbed my attention in the best possible way. You were talking about no matter how much research you do for your book, no matter how many notes you take, don't tell the reader everything. Like, leave
Yes.
space for them to tell themselves their own stories. And I'm the classic reader who tells myself more stories about, you know, characters that I'm reading about in books that I'm reading. But I mean, you and I have both read things where the author tells you everything. Where did you start of like, okay, I need to write a post about this. I need to get this out of my head and talk about this more.
Well, I've been teaching lately, so I've been reading a lot of student works. And a lot of student works have this problem where they want to not just write that the characters, you know, left the living room and went to the restaurant, but they want to write that the characters left the living room, crossed the porch, went to the driveway, got in the car, closed the car doors, and then started driving. And
And you don't need that level of detail. You don't.
you don't. Some of it might simply be they're writing their way into the story, which is perfectly understandable, or they're afraid they're not going to meet the word count for the assignment I gave them, which is also understandable, and I get it. We've all padded a thing here or there, but I'm not going to call out the student in particular that made me just sit down and say, oh, I need to write about this because, yeah. They are a brilliant, talented young person and they will go far. All of my students are that, even if they aren't young people. Actually, I don't remember if it was a young person or not. I teach volunteer classes through Literary Cleveland, and my students tend to be some high schoolers, some college age, a lot of retirees, so all over the spectrum.
And they're learning how to write, and you know,
Yeah.
writing too much detail is one way to write a
And
first draft.
I find that helping other people learn how to write helps articulate to myself what is working and what isn't working in my own work. Working on another blog post titled "What Teaching Has Taught Me." It's not just commas, although I'm really good at my commas now.
I feel like I use too many commas, which I think is a sign to myself that my sentences are too long.
use as many commas as you want. I'm variable on it. I also say don't die on any hills for any commas. If your publisher says cut this comma, cut the comma. But grammar is an interesting thing. Grammar is all consensus-based, and
And it changes.
it's changed in my lifetime. I can tell you that. The whole thing with two spaces after a period versus one, which people are all hung up about, and I'm like, hey.
And it's not a hill I'm gonna die on, but I grew
No.
up with two spaces after a
Right, and it's
period.
muscle memory now,
It
so I just.
is. It is. But so social media has actually helped me change to the only one space, because it saves me a character. And then I can like cram in that longer word later.
Right.
So.
And also, I think myself, and I remember this point in my past as a writer where I would over polish. Remember, I started submitting novels for publication when I was 17.
That is amazing. I love that.
I know they were terrible, but I submitted three different novels for publication
But the fact that
in my
you,
high school.
it, I don't think you realize how impressive it is to finish a novel and submit it at such a young age. Like that is an accomplishment. Just starting something and finishing it and submitting it.
Well, I wanted to write novels. That was the thing I wanted to do with my life. And when I graduated high school without having sold one, and I got some really nice personalized rejection letters too, like handwritten notes from Ace and Doubleday, which if I had known better, I would have saved. Instead, I was like, that's it. I'm ruined. I'm 19 now. I'm no longer a prodigy. I cannot publish because I can't bank on that. And I'm afraid that I won't be able to compete on a more fair scale. And it took me years to recover from that feeling. And I switched to short stories, which was good ultimately because short stories taught me so much more about structure. I could finish a short story faster and I could edit a short story faster. And I could then see the problems with plot and structure faster. But then again, I submitted my first short story for publication when I was 19, and I sold my first short story when I was 39.
That's
So,
okay.
I am not a prodigy. I am the person on the very slow path.
But you're also the person that is willing to look at what you've written, look at the structure, say, "Hey, this is the part right here that might not be working," and fix it.
Right.
And a lot of people won't do that.
But then after you get to the point where you're good at, well, yeah, and I know, and believe me, I ran into it a lot in college where I would trade critiques with a friend and I would say, okay, there's this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem. And they would say, yeah, you don't understand my vision.
That's not how a critique conversation works.
I'm like, well, why do you think I don't understand your vision? But after you get to that point where you're good at accepting criticism and revising to it, you have to get to the point where you stop revising and where you stop accepting all criticism because no story is everything to everyone. And you can end up editing a story
You
into
just
a
edit
formless,
it to death. You've
right,
gotta,
into a formless paste.
and it's, you incorporate this person's feedback, and you incorporate this other person's feedback, and you incorporate this other person's feedback, and at a certain point it's gonna stop being the story you are writing and just be a reflection of what other people told you.
Yeah, I joined a writing workshop way too young. I joined at 16, though I'm not complaining. It was very kind of Mary Trizillo to invite me into her writing workshop. And I learned a lot from the Cajun Sushi Hamsters, whom I still once a month, hang out with and critique stories with. But yes, I would find myself editing the story so it would appeal to the NASA physicist who likes hard science fiction, so it would appeal to the professor of Shakespeare who really likes things to be dark and emotionally complicated, and also so it would appeal to the engineer who writes horror. And it didn't work, and it took me a long time to learn that, to learn that I had to say, okay, what is my vision for this story? I actually had one. Maybe part of that is I've always had crippling low self-esteem, so I never had any trouble with learning to edit and revise. I had trouble with learning to trust myself, even trusting myself enough to say, I'm writing a Jeff story, so I'm going to listen to Jeff's critique and not Mary's. And this story, this is a Mary story. So I'm going to listen to Mary's critique and ignore Jeff. And I'm sure my writing workshop is not surprised to learn that I do that sometimes. I'm sitting there smiling and nodding and typing, and I'm saying, I don't care what you say, Jeff. This is not your story.
But you still nod and smile, and
Yes, no, yeah. And I still appreciate the feedback when I do write a more Jeff story, or a more Darren story, or a more Neela story. And it took me realizing that when you're writing a short story, you're writing to an audience. And science fiction fans is not, is way too broad to be the only audience that you're looking at. I think, and again, thinking back to old, 20-year-old me, why can't I sell a novel? I wanted my novels to appeal to everyone, right? That's what she was like, it's going to be a bestseller and everyone will want to read it. No, that doesn't work. You can't write for everyone. You have to write for your specific niche. And when I wrote Galactic Hellcats, my first novel to sell, my first big success in the novel world, it was something I wrote specifically for 14-year-old me, or for 40-year-old me. Let's be real. I wrote it for Marie Vibert. This was what Marie Vibert wanted to read. And it did very well. It was a British Science Fiction Award long list. So pretty great for an indie pub.
Pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. I might just have to read it again. So there, because it was
Another
it got written
copy.
for 40 something me too.
They make great coasters, good gifts, and if there's a corner of your couch that's like a half inch too short,
It is like
I'm
a
all
half
ears.
inch, yeah. So yeah, folks listening, it is not one of those 900-page doorstoppers. You can read it in a week, likely less because the story just goes. It's
I
fantastic.
had one person message me the day after it launched and said they stayed up late and read it. And I was like, do you have any idea how long that took to write?
And they zipped through it in like
In
9
1 night.
hours in one night. It's very fast-paced. So, like, I certainly was that person at 11:30 at night saying, "No, Andrea, you need to go to bed. Put the book down, turn the light out. You have to go to bed." And it's written in such a way that it's just, "No, I'll just read one more chapter tonight. I'll just read one more chapter." So I
Wow.
can, yeah, I can absolutely see someone saying, "I'm just going to stay up and read this whole thing." So
That's my own personal fondness for the sadistic cliffhanger at the end of each chapter. I just love doing that.
ugh, you're such a jerk. We're never
I
going to get
am.
any sleep thanks to you. Such a jerk. Some of
I
us have to
am.
get up at like stupid crack of dawn for work. But no, I'm just going to keep reading until 4 o'clock in the morning.
And you can kind of blame my writing in junior high school for that too, because I used to, when I was writing those novels in junior high, I would write one chapter at a time and then hand the notebook to my sister to read. And then she would be like, ah, you left it on a cliffhanger. And I'd be like, oh.
I love that so much. Well, thanks so much for hanging out with me today, and I really enjoy talking with you about really just about a whole collection of things. So thanks for putting up with my brain that was just jumping all over the place, talking about Worldcon and talking about novels and writing short stories. For folks that neglected to write anything down at the beginning of this podcast, would you tell us again where we can find you online? If you have any social media platforms that you're active on that you want people to look for you at?
Sure. Yes. Obviously, my website, mariebibbert.com. You'll find my blog there. And also, I have a contact page where you can find all my social medias. I'm on Blue Sky and Mastodon as Reasy, R-E-A-S-I-E. I'm on the Bird site as Ma Reasy, because Reasy was taken. I'm on Instagram and TikTok as Marie Vibert, and also the Book of the Faces. And yeah, follow me everywhere. I update my blog pretty regularly with tips and tricks on writing, and also anything I feel like ranting about.
The perfect blog is tips and tricks plus whatever I feel like talking about.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again so much. I really enjoy getting to spend some time with you today.
Thank you. Me too. I enjoyed this.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.